that makes them more dangerous than even physical diseases, right? But when it comes to the spiritual aspect and the spiritual diseases, these are things that continue on into the next world, and that is something that, you know, we really do need to get rid of. Now, we're talking about these diseases. What do we need to do? Well, first and foremost, we need to, sit down and think and list these kind of diseases that we have, and diseases that Islam speaks about, whether, for example, it's lying or backbiting or gossiping, watching bad things or listening to bad things or using swear words or listening to swear words. There's a whole host, greed and jealousy and carnal desires. There's a whole host of things, you know, out there which, are diseases, and they're spiritual diseases. You list all of these, and then one by one, you find ways to be able to solve these spiritual diseases. One thing, though, before we end the program, is that make sure that you know and you believe from the bottom of your heart that you are able to fix these spiritual diseases, of course, with the help and the grace of the Almighty Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
By continuing to arm the Zionist regime as it engineers a famine in Gaza, the U.S. regime is disregarding its own domestic law, which prohibits the provision of military assistance to states that block humanitarian aid provided by Washington. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, over the past 6 months in Gaza, the Zionist regime has killed civilians on an industrial scale, turned hospitals into strategic military targets, and food into a weapon of war. Blatantly violating basic principles of the laws of war, the Zionist regime has deployed the language of international humanitarian law as a form of humanitarian camouflage, in the words of independent UN expert Francesca Albanese, in the furtherance of its genocidal campaign. In her new report titled Anatomy of a Genocide, Albanese says that one of her key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted just in bello principles, subverting their protective functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. Jus in bello refers to the conditions under which states may legitimately resort to war. It regulates the conduct of parties engaged in an armed conflict. International humanitarian law, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, is synonymous with jus in bello. It seeks to minimize suffering in armed conflicts, notably by protecting and assisting all victims of armed conflict to the greatest extent possible. In the absence of such accountability measures for the past and ongoing rights violations and enabled by decades of impunity, Israel's total war on Palestinians in Gaza is also a war on the principles of international law, the impact of which will surely be profound. Albania's report finds that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating Israel's commission of genocide is met, while arguing that its conduct complies with international humanitarian law. According to Albania's, the Zionist regime's actions have been driven by a genocidal logic integral to its settler colonial project in Palestine, signaling a tragedy foretold. She explains that settler colonialism is a dynamic, structural process and a confluence of acts aimed at displacing and eliminating indigenous groups, of which genocidal extermination and annihilation represents the peak. The genocidal logic underpinning Israel's violence in Gaza, now at an annihilationist peak, is not new. And the Zionist regime's past practices, including persecution and discrimination, lay the groundwork for the current eliminationist stage. The Zionist regime has advanced its settler colonial project through military occupation and various repressive measures, according to Albanese. This has involved construing Palestinians as a security threat to justify their oppression and de-civilization, namely, the denial of their status as protected civilians, she adds. The denial of Palestinians' status as protected civilians has reached its most extreme point in the genocide currently unfolding in Gaza, during which more than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed and thousands more are missing and presumed dead. The Zionist regime siege warfare, the aim of which is to achieve by starvation what could not be achieved by military force, according to civil rights lawyer and writer Dylan Saba, may prove even more deadly than its weapons. A recent Integrated Food Security Phase Classification IPC analysis determined that almost all of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people were enduring extreme hunger and around half were in a situation of catastrophic food insecurity. The international charity Oxfam says that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in northern Gaza, where the Zionist regime is preventing the UN from delivering aid in violation of recent legally binding decisions by the Security Council and World Court, are forced to survive on an average of 245 calories a day, less than a can of fava beans, since January. Albanese states in her report, a quarter of Gaza's population is at risk of death from preventable health conditions within a year. The Zionist regime's airstrikes, which have obliterated countless Palestinian families in their homes, are carried out with a similarly appalling disregard for human life. According to Plus 972 magazine, an Israeli publication, the military relied on an artificial intelligence program that it developed to target as many as 37,000 Palestinians as suspected militants for possible airstrikes in the first weeks of the war. Human personnel rubber stamped the machine-generated targets with no requirement to thoroughly check why the machine made those choices or to examine the raw intelligence data on which they were based, Plus 972 reported. The targets generated by the artificial intelligence were bombed in homes without hesitation as a first option, an intelligence officer told Plus 972, saying it's much easier to bomb a family's home. The system is built to look for them in these situations. Military sources told the publication that the army preferred to use unguided missiles known as dumb bombs when targeting the people with one intelligence officer stating that you don't want to waste expensive bombs on unimportant people. Two sources told Plus 972 that for every Hamas fighter that the artificial intelligence system marked, it was permissible to kill up to 15 to 20 civilians. The fact that the Zionist regime's military censors allowed for the publication of the Plus 972 stories suggests that the regime may attempt to place responsibility for the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian civilians on a machine algorithm.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست. ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
July 12, 1983, Place Hosseinia Jamaran, Tehran. Ambition is the result of lack of purification of the soul. The objective is that Islam should get moving. The objective is not that I should implement it. Of the things that a person suffers from is this eternal evil, which urges him to take change of efforts. If the job is performed in a better way by means of another person makes him unhappy and he say that it is good that he stays. This arises from the internal mischief of a person. A person with the holy attitude prepares a plan to attain such a reward.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. On the subject of evanescence of this life, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, youth with its delights and gratifications are soon past. Well, here Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is talking about the impermanence of this life. You know, life progresses through natural cycles, through the peaks of health and wealth and the valleys of weakness and scarcity. Nature itself is a reminder of this. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said in that regard, opportunities pass like the passing of clouds, so make use of good opportunities. Every moment that we have in this life is an opportunity, in fact. In youth, we are busy planning for life and running after different obligations. Time never seems to be enough, but at this age, we are often blessed with health, strength, and optimism. As we progress into old age, our health may be deteriorating, but free time is a valuable blessing that we can always avail. Life is an opportunity in itself, and it is in its turn full of countless opportunities that are always open to man and that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes available to his servants one after another.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
Allah,
There are opportunities of all types and in every field. Some of them change the entire course of people's lives, while others effect drastic changes for those who seize them and make the best of them. Some opportunities, however, never reoccur. An opportunity may be an act of obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or a pious act to build the nation and help develop society. It may be high status or position which can be used in the service of the religion and the ummah or people. Those who seize these opportunities and take initiative go many stages and levels ahead of others. The point that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi made is the same. We should try our best to take advantage of our youth in order to progress in spirituality and in that way please our Lord.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
Conversation. Hello, I'm Danny Morrison, and welcome to a special edition of The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs around Ireland. My next guest is the author of a remarkably researched book which deals with the Algerian War of Independence and makes comparisons between Ireland and the subject of settler colonialism. There's also an important book in terms of how establishment media works and how the British media, which condemned the struggle for independence in Ireland, cheered on a much bloodier conflict in Algeria, which eventually led to Algerian independence.
My next guest is none other than the author, Patrick Anderson. Pat, I'm going to call you Pat. Okay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you were a working class boy, grammar school boy. Could you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
I grew up in North Belfast, but went to school in West Belfast up the Glen Road. So I have a bit of a foot in both camps. What was going on at the time up in Andersonstown. So I was there every day at school, with my friends, and then of course going back in the evening to North Belfast. So gives you a good flavour of what was going on in the city at that time.
Was there many others in your family went to university?
No, I'm the first one. It was a bit of a story, me going to university. I dropped out twice. I went to study aero engineering, I went to study ecology, and eventually ended up studying, well, what would be called today PPE, politics, philosophy, and economics, but sort of make your way to it.
But what brought you onto the subject of Algeria?
Well, it's sort of curious in a way. I mean, you start reading any politics, you start learning about colonialism, and there's always, you know, small references to the French in North Africa. But also, you would always get, oh, it's not the same as here. I actually went along with that for the longest time, till I started, you know, the usual story. You read more, and you start asking another question. I got more interesting. Everybody started telling me, it's not the same. I believed them. These are people who were professors and teachers. And then you start reading again. You start asking different questions. And then you don't get the answer.
Well, tell me, I mean, initially, when you came across the subject of French in Algeria, you saw comparisons between the British and Ireland. But give our viewers a flavour of that conflict and how it came about.
Well, the French-Algerian conflict is 1954 to 1962. In the French world, it is literally the biggest war of the 20th century, or we'll exclude the Second World War. It's like the Vietnam War in the English-speaking world. It's a hugely bloody conflict. From the French point of view, it's just across the water to the Mediterranean. You could kick the boat off from Marseille and you get into North Africa. Just an unbelievably bloody struggle. The comparisons would seem really obvious, and why it also concerned me, why does everybody say it's not the same? You know, you have French settlers in North Africa.
They're from the mid-19th century.
So it's shorter than the length of time that the British are here. And that's always used, that the French were there for such a shorter time. It's actually a false denial, really, because the period of time that the French were there, it was a mass participatory French democracy, and here they are in North Africa. Whereas the British in Ireland, it's a slowly expanding oligarchic elite. So it's different. In other words, the saying that the British have been here longer denies the French being in North Africa shorter, denies the analogy. In fact, it's the other way around.
So they took over Algeria mid-19th century, and in order to control it, they engaged in settler colonialism.
Yeah, so they sent, it's really good question that any settler colonialism is really different from colonialism. Settler colonialism is people call them settlers, call them migrants. It's always a contested label. They go to a different part of the world with the express intention of taking the land and settling. It's not like a colony where there's our administrators who are just basically there to extract, and they use local elites and help them. In a sense, you know, they're not as disruptive. They're robbing, of course, but it's just administrators from the imperial center, where settlers is an entirely different thing. They come with the intention of staying, which means they have to move people off the land, and then they have a difficult relationship with the mother country.
Was there initial resistance to the settler colonialism in Algeria?
There was, of course, and the French used, you know, all these countries who were settled by the Europeans, look, the Europeans were pretty good at organizing violence. That's the thing. The European armies, you could not stand up to them, all of these countries, and so the French army would have been the same. They imposed their will by military force. It's the same story that, you know, the French did everywhere, or the British did everywhere around the world.
Well, here in Ireland, of course, you've got lots of examples of resistance to the British presence, or the English presence initially. So when did really resistance take off in Algeria?
Well, you know, almost right away. And the The French, of course, used the very same tactics that the British would have done around the world, like scorched earth tactics. So you see, it's so hard for the native population to resist that. These come in with organized force, and like immediately after 1830, when the French arrive, the big Algerian hero is a guy called Sheikh El Kadir, who, in our terms today, would have been considered a jihadist from that time, but also he would have been a person who wanted to preserve human rights and lives, and he tried to protect civilians, really, and he did some things in Damascus, for example, where he's really honored today. But anyway, he led a resistance against the French. In the end, the French prevail.
So, interestingly, your PhD on the conflict in Algeria and the struggle for independence also took in major part British media's response to that. So what did that tell you about the situation?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So really how I came to study French North Africa was through the study of Noam Chomsky. And Chomsky is the big media analyst. So, I mean, I had been involved in projects, different parts of the world, Angola, Mozambique, Central America, and these are all, you know, modern day or had been, you know, problems. And Chomsky had written a lot on this. So I started to become quite familiar with Chomsky's work, and Chomsky's work had, you know, worked in explaining how different conflicts in the modern world had been propagated in the American media. And I thought, I should do this for Ireland, because here I was abroad a lot, and people had such a poor idea of what went on in Ireland. Basically, it was a religious squabble.
Mm-hmm.
You and I know that's not the case, but it was so prevalent. I said, how can I bring this to people's attention? Chomsky. Now, one thing Chomsky's model really needs is a matched historic pair. Well, it seemed to me so obvious, French Algeria. So obvious that everybody told me, don't go there. But once you go, you can see that the similarities are just remarkable.
So you adopted the PhD as a textbook on Algeria and on the media. So what happened? What was the progress from there on?
The first publication was by Cork University Press, but it ran into trouble with the late journalist Henry MacDonald. Now, it would be true to say it doesn't come out of the book looking well, because this is a looking at people's journalistic output over a long period of time, and then I'm taking it apart because I'm putting it up against the historic record. He threatened legal action, and Cork University Press withdrew it. I told them, look, it would be impossible with his background for him to win the legal battle.
Basically, you said he was associated with the Workers' Party, which he was, and he took exception to that.
He took exception to that, and also another journalist joined him. And so the coordination of it made Cork run. But the other journalist, to his credit, immediately withdrew and apologised.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard to look on it as not like coordinated.
So the book was basically...
So the book was pulled in.
And pulled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's, of course, why I have to declare an interest in that you brought to my attention, and I helped edit it and get the book published. It was published 18 months ago, and was well received in many, many circles. I mean, you came across some very interesting research in terms of people who were involved in our conflict here, but who were also, in a sense, cheerleaders in the British media.
If you look, this method of studying the media is called the propaganda model. And people immediately say, oh, this is a conspiracy model. But I have to make it clear, it's not a conspiracy model at all. It's an extended, long, long extended look at the output of the media from one conflict and a very similar one, and you can compare them. So it's a huge, really, amount of work. Whether anyone is a propagandist or not, that's not the point. The point is looking at the final output and how did it get there. Now, you put forward explanations of how it may have happened, but really the point is, here's what did happen. Here's this output, and here's that output. Remarkably similar conflicts. How come this is the output here, and how come it's completely different here? And Chomsky's model is that the output will prioritize power, and so it does.
And what about some of the personalities involved in both conflicts? Yeah.
So for me then, I had to look at people who had, you know, reported in Algeria and reported in the conflict in the north of Ireland. So that was sort of hard to find, but I eventually did find 10 people, which was great for me. So these people are actually eyewitnesses to the Algerian conflict and eyewitnesses in Ireland. And why they're so important is, what you learn is ideas that they have internalized. Now remember, I've got an advantage over them because I'm reading everything at the time. My advantage is they might know their little corner of the conflict, but I've looked at the whole lot. And most of them have internalized wrong ideas. I'll give you a small example. For these British journalists who had been in Algeria and the same in Ireland, they would always say to me, oh, Ireland is, you know, not as bad as Algeria because of this incident called the Rue de Isly massacre, which is basically Bloody Sunday in Algeria. If you look at the figures for the Bloody Sunday killings and the Rue de Isly, there were more people killed, about 45. The difference is this. What happened on the Rue de Isly was the French soldiers opened fire for seven minutes. They opened fire, 9 of them. The eyewitnesses, these British journalists who were there, saw their officers slapping their faces to get them to stop. Bloody Sunday is different. There are less people killed, but behind it, there's a much more sinister thing going on. Ministry of Defence, making the soldiers go up on that day, filling their heads full of what they're going to do. So, the numbers are smaller, but what happened in Algeria was a spontaneous, terrible event, Bloody Sunday. There's far more behind it. But these journalists all had it the other way around.
What was the role? I mean, Conor Cruz O'Brien, who became Minister of Posts and Telegraphs in the Dublin government, and who was instrumental in police and censorship with Section 31. What was his role in terms of the coverage of Algeria?
Yeah, so Conor Cruz O'Brien was a big sort of expert. He sort of fell in love with Algeria. He worked in the French embassy in Paris at the time, and so he had a lot to say on Algeria, and wrote about Camus and their very famous books and everything. And basically, O'Brien himself acknowledges that he was a big advocate for the FLN, who were like extremely ruthless. Not to me to deny these people their independence, but the FLN and the ALN themselves will acknowledge how ruthless they were. Conor Cruz O'Brien cheered them on. But O'Brien is important for us because O'Brien, his analysis of the conflict in the north of Ireland basically framed nearly all of the media analysis in the British media on Ireland. O'Brien, basically his ideas, framed it all. To shorten it, it was a religious conflict, not the legacy of colonialism. The other way around in Algeria, Algeria was written up as the classic anti-imperial war. There was, in fact, a great deal of a religious dimension behind it. So the two things are sort of stood on their head.
And what about that journalist John Cole, who was from Belfast? He became a political correspondent in London. And how did he frame the presentation and the perception of our conflict here?
So Cole is very much like Conor Cruz O'Brien because he's a pivotal person in the presentation of the conflict in Ireland. He's the sort of in-house expert for The Guardian and Observer at the time. At the time, seen as, you know, the most left-wing and progressive newspapers. But John Cole himself would have been described in his obituary as a true Protestant son of Belfast, meaning he was a real unionist. However, Merlin Reich, Reginald Maudling, Jim Callaghan, all of them went to him for advice. His view of the north of Ireland went in the Guardian.
So what other observations did you make about the British media's role in our conflict here?
O'Brien and Cole basically turned the Algerian analysis on its head. The Algerian conflict does have a religious dimension and an anti-imperial dimension. but it's portrayed as the classic anti-imperial struggle, and the religious dimension is overlooked. Whereas in the north of Ireland, they boosted this religious angle and pushed aside almost entirely the legacy of colonialism. So they basically turned it on its head. But there were so many similarities. So sometimes the people who gave it away are very interesting. So, for example, Noel Little, Emma Little Pengelly's father, who's a gun runner. Now, Emma, when they asked him, why did you do it? Very interestingly, he said, to stop Britain doing in Algeria. I remember going, good man, Noel, you know what you're talking about. But everybody else denies it. But the French Parliament referred to Algeria as France's Ireland. Mm-hmm. They knew. And Harold Wilson, when his cabinet secretly discussed withdrawn. From the north. They discussed withdrawn under the code word Algeria. This is the place that everybody tells me it's not the same. And there were American academics when they first came over and recorded British soldiers here. The officers now, they're all saying things like this. Oh, yeah, the French have been through all this in Algeria. All these things get written out of the media, but you see, I have the original ones. So you see, how do these things disappear? But then it gets even more interesting. Then you get Kitson himself, who quotes Colonel Roger Trinquier. Now, Roger Trinquier was right at the heart of the Battle of Algiers, and he made no bones about it. You have to torture these guys to get information out of it. Now, not all the French officers wanted to torture them, because a lot of them knew it doesn't work anyway. People under torture will tell you anything, yeah. You see. But Trinquier, he believed no, torture them, and Kitson quotes Trinquier. And so he followed Trinquier. But, the similarities, Danny, are beyond belief. Lord Carrington, resigned over the Falklands but didn't resign over torture. Now, we now know that Carrington signed off on the torture. Yeah. At the time, we didn't know. But when the Compton Inquiry was first written on the torture here in the north, Compton quotes almost verbatim Pere de la Rue, who was the chaplain to the paratroopers in Algiers. And his famous quote was, you have to do this. Don't take any joy out of it, but it's a necessity. And if you read through Compton, you go, I read this before. That's Pere de la Rue. The similarities, but it goes even further than that. So there are more similarities. And it's the other way this time. It's the Algerians looking at Ireland. And the original Algerian, the ALN, took their inspiration from Michael Collins. And so, and they're as schoolboys. They're all going, this Michael Collins guy's great. These IRA guys are great. They get Ireland out from under Britain. And these are boys at school who grow up to be the leaders of the Algerian rising. So the Algerians are copying the Irish, and the British are copying the French in Algeria.
Well, the thing is, of course, whenever de Gaulle betrayed the army, so to speak, there was a reaction against de Gaulle, you know, and attempts of explosions and attempts of assassination, etc. But there was no similar thing here in Britain by the army, apart from 1974, what's it called, Operation Clockwork Orange.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's a really good example, Danny, because, you see, the French, in a sense, are way more honest than the British. There's a real political divide in France. So, and even the French officers, like, debated in public about the torture. And you had other French officers say, no, we can't do that. It brings dishonor on the French army. So they are discussed. I'm not excusing the French. I'm just saying they're open about it. Whereas the British, you know, we never tortured. It doesn't come out at all. So there was opposition to de Gaulle in the French, but the British army never got any opposition. And the British army, you know, soldiers would sit down with the, you know, head of the opposition. They all went to school together in a sense. Mm-hmm. So there was never that real division that the British army would be upset with their political leadership. because the political leadership in Britain never went against the army. Mm. The army asked for it, they got it. Do you know who we know who we can thank for that? Gareth Fitzgerald, because he's the one that told us. When the British sit down with the generals, if the generals ask for it, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's Gareth. He was in the IRA, wasn't he?
His father was in the GPO. So it ends with the decolonization of Algeria. It ends with the Pied Noir, vast majority of them going back to France. Mm-hmm. Here, the term settler colonialism is seen as pejorative, and the unionists have taken exception to it, even though in the past they have used the term.
Well, you're so right, Danny. And I did face opposition from people saying to me, you know, this is a pejorative term against unionism. Look, in academia, it is not. It's an explanatory tool. So when we talk about settler colonialism, what we're talking about is, if you talk about colonialism, you're talking about an invasion. But settler colonialism is a structure. In other words, the invasion never stops. It just keeps on going. That is, you have a structure of displacing the people before. Now, that's been overturned quite a bit with the Good Friday Agreement. So this idea of being called a settler, you will get young progressive unionists today who find it, you know, it's difficult if you're a young progressive unionist because of this colonial label hanging over them. And it sits uneasily off the shelf of a liberal Protestant. But look, for the longest time, Paisley, for example, would have went on about his good settler stock. You know, it would have been an honorific in the past. But after the Second World War, you know, if you're the colonist, basically, you're the bad guy. You're the one that caused the trouble, not the guys who are fighting against you. In fact, it seems that the natives, if we call the Irish the natives or the Algerians the natives, I mean, it's a pretty rational thing to do, to try and oppose what's being done on you. So the violence then comes initially from the settler. So settler colonialism is difficult for a progressive young unionist, but it's a tool that's used all around the world. It explains Algeria, it explains Australia, America, Argentina. They don't like to use it here, but it explains the north of Ireland too. So, yes, people don't like it because, well, it really means the focus shouldn't be on the rebels, the IRA. The focus should be on the settlers and the policies of London. What's the cause of all this? And hence we get this problem about rewriting the past, which is a bugaboo for all of unionism.
Well, Pat, thanks for coming along today. That was a fascinating insight into the parallels between Ireland and Algeria and on the whole subject of media distortion of our conflict here. And that's it for another week. The conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. Until next time, I'm Donnie Morrison, and this has been The Conversation. Bye for now.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. Inshallah, today we'll talk about Ayah 38 of Surah An-Nisa on page 85. So, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Ali Nasir and Fawad, let's all together first listen to the recitation.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ رِئَاءَ النَّاسِ وَلَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَلَا بِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ لَهُ قَرِينًا فَسَاءَ قَرِينًا.
MashaAllah, that was a nice recitation. So, let me read it once. We'll mention some points here, inshallah. Then we'll move on to the tajweed rules. Allah Almighty says in Ayah 38 of Surah An-Nisa on page 85 of the Quran Kareem, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ رِئَاءَ النَّاسِ ولا يؤمنون بالله ولا باليوم الآخر ومن يكن الشيطان له قرينا فساء قرينا.
Very, very beautiful ayah. And those who spend their wealth to be seen by people and believe neither in Allah nor in the last day. وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ لَهُ قَرِينًا. As for him who has said, and for his companion, okay, like whoever has said, shaytan as his companion or friend, okay, who is that shaytan? What kind of companion is that shaytan? He is فَسَاءَ قَرِينًا. An evil companion is he, said, okay. So guys, this ayah talks about the previous part of the discussion that we had in the previous sessions. Allah Almighty was talking about those who are mukhtalan fakhura in ayah 36, okay? Those who are what? Swaggering braggart. In the ayah 37, Allah said, أَلَّذِينَ يَبْخَلُونَ وَيَأْمُرُونَ النَّاسِ بِالْبُخْلِ. They are stingy. And also in this ayah, Allah Almighty says one of the other attributes, okay? Of the مُخْتَالَ فَخُورَ, the people with that kind of quality. وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ, they are those who spend their wealth not for Allah Almighty. They help the poor, okay? They help the needy, okay? Not for Allah Almighty. So if it is not for the Allah, listen, intention in Islam, okay? In actions, in a'mal, okay? Intention is very important. إِنَّمَا الْأَعْمَالُ بِالنِّيَّاتِ. So if you want Allah Almighty to accept your prayers, to accept your the wudu that you perform, to accept the fasting, to accept the hajj, your intention should be for Allah Almighty. Purely for Allah Almighty. Allah Almighty will not accept because your niyyah is not for Allah Almighty. Ask the reward from the one whom you pray for the pleasure of them. Okay, that's it. So وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ, they are those who spend their wealth رِئَاءَ النَّاسِ, not for Allah Almighty. For what? To be seen by people. Hey people, gather. Okay, what are you gonna do? I'm gonna help this poor person. Look, you should see how gentle I am. Look, I'm helping this poor. So, this kind of person, must never expect Allah Almighty to reward him in the Day of Judgment. Why? Because Allah Almighty says, وَلَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَلَا بِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ. They don't believe in Allah Almighty. They don't believe in the Day of Judgment. If they believed, they would never, for example, show themselves off, okay? They would really care about What about the dignity of the person, the poor person, okay? And Allah Almighty will reward or punish them. If his action is the intention is for Allah Almighty, he will get rewards from Allah Almighty in the Day of Judgment. Even if he does not believe, Allah Almighty will reward him in this world as well, okay? But if he, okay, if he does not believe in the Day of Judgment and Allah Almighty, we believe that the Day of Judgment is going to happen, okay? So it's going to come, he will be punished for sure, because he did not really respect the dignity of that person, the personality of that poor person. So if you help a poor person, make sure you care about the dignity as well. Even if you don't help, at least respect that person. Do not disrespect. That's it, okay? So these kind of people who do not believe in the Day of Judgment and they spend their wealth and for the sake of people, okay, to be seen by people, so they are actually friends with Shaitan. So Shaitan is a very bad friend and evil. So we always have to say, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. So that's it. Refer to the Tafasir books, inshallah, for more information, for more details. It's time to mention some important tajweed rules, then inshallah practice the recitation.
Qur'ani nabdu hayati, Qur'ani tahra dhati, Qur'ani asmatu amri, Qur'ani tawqu najati. Qur'ani
nabdu hayati. How to learn Qur'an easy? What is the correct way to read the Qur'an? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with let's recite the Quran.
Ali Nasir and Fawad, you are so quiet today because I think you really love the discussion. So, but from now on, I won't let you stay quiet, okay? I'll ask you a lot of questions. You got to help me out with the Tajweed rules. Ready?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. The very first one. Tell me the pronunciations of the letters which are important here. Which letters are important, Ali Nasir?
First, we have Wow.
Wow, it should be wa, not va.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Letter val.
Val.
Qaf.
Qaf, okay. Qa. It's different from ka.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Hamza.
Hamza. It's not a. It's different from ain. Good job.
We have ha.
Ha. It's different from ha. We got two ha. Ha exists in English. The counterpart for H, the letter H. I'm home. He is right. Okay.
Yeah.
Ha, who? Yeah. He have, has. So this ha. But ha doesn't exist in English. So this is different. This is ha, which exists in English. Continue forward, please. Next. وَلَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَلَا بِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِيرِ وَمَنْ يَكُنِشْ آخِير. خَا. But here it's pronounced lightly. It's important to know, yes?
Yes.
Because when it has a kasra, it's pronounced lightly. Isan. Khi.
Yes, then ta.
Ta, shaytan. Good job. Qarina, again.
Qaf.
Qaf, yeah. That's all. That's all, right? So, let's mention the other rules. These are about the pronunciations of the letters that, which really matter. If you don't pronounce them correctly, it might be difficult for you, but practice them and pronounce them correctly. So, the next point. وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ. Why I didn't pronounce the noon clearly? You didn't hear the sound of noon correctly, yes?
Yes.
يُنْفِقُونَ. No way. Fawad wanted to tell me that you don't know how to read. Yeah, I don't know, but tell me, help me, Fawad. So, tell me, Fawad. Yeah, he was joking. So...
Yeah, because you applied the rule.
In fact, I knew, yes? Mm, yeah, so I...
yes.
Yes. So I applied the rule...
Ikhfa.
Ikhfa. So what is it? What does the rule ikhfa mean?
Hiding the sound of the noon sakin or tanween.
Whenever the letter fa, ta, tha, sin, sheen, sa, ta, kaf... like
which letters which are not categorized in the other three?
Yeah, good, good. We got four groups of letters... So, the letters for the rule idgham, ya, ra, mim, lam, waw, noon, these six letters in one group. hamza, ha, ha, kha, ayn, ghain in one group, the letter ba only in one group, so, and the rest of the letters. So for the rest of the letters, whenever they appear right after the tanwin or nun sakin, you hide the sound of it. Yes? Nasal sound, and also prolong it for two counts. وَالَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ رِئَاءَ النَّاسِ رِئَاءَ. The mother is wajib. Stretch it for six counts or five counts. النَّاسِ نُون مُشَدَّد. Pay attention. Stretch the sound for two beats. And also a nasal sound. وَلَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَلَا بِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ. On the top, if you see, there is a sign called Qila, which says...
It is recommended to stop here.
Yeah, it's better to stop here, but you can continue, right?
Yes.
وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ وَمَنْ نُنْ سَاكِنْ plus يَا
إِدْغَام
from the group of يَرْمَلُونَ. So yes. The rule إِدْغَام is applied, merge the sound, and وَمَيْ مَنْ مَيْ changes to مَيْ. Yeah. وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ لَهُ قَرِينًا فَسَاءَ. Again, قَرِينًا تَنْوِين plus فَا, the same as يُنْفِقُونَ, hide the sound.
Yes.
قَرِينًا فَسَاءَ قَرِينًا. The mad, right? The mad is wajib here. That's all. The tajweed rules are easy in this ayah. Let's repeat after me, okay? You all repeat after me. I'll recite it. Brothers and sisters will also recite, inshallah. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
والذين ينفقون أموالهم رئاء الناس ولا يؤمنون بالله ولا باليوم الآخر
والذين ينفقون أموالهم رئاء الناس ولا يؤمنون بالله ولا باليوم الآخر.
آخر, when you read it, when you stop here, the را is pronounced lightly because yes. There is a كسرة sound. ولا باليوم الآخر. All right.
وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ لَهُ قَرِينًا فَسَاءَ قَرِينًا وَمَنْ يَكُنِ الشَّيْطَانُ لَهُ قَرِينًا فَسَاءَ قَرِينًا.
أحسنتم ما شاء الله. صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
ما شاء الله. Allah bless you, inshallah. That's all for today, brothers and sisters. Stay with Arab English Radio, inshallah. Thank you so much, Fawad and Ali Nasir. Thanks for being with us today. Inshallah, we'll be here with you. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Let's recite the Quran. A joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان
إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.